I'm Jill Surgeson, a nurse midwife and researcher fascinated by the concept of trust and its role in our most meaningful relationships. Trust isn't just personal. It influences our health, our communities, and our institutions. In this podcast, we'll explore how trust manifests across different aspects of society, where it thrives, where it breaks down, and what we can do to build it. Through conversations with experts from a variety of disciplines, we'll examine how trustworthiness can lead to a more equitable and fulfilling world. Welcome to Trust Fund. I remember the time I first heard the expression fake news. Fake news? As I was growing up, my family got the news from our small-town newspaper and Tom Brokaw at 6 o'clock on the television. Although it occurred to me that news could be biased, I associated fake news with flimsy editions of the National Enquirer I saw at the grocery store checkout line. Now, of course, allegations of fake news and literal fake news is everywhere. In an age where we depend so much on the media to keep us informed, how do we trust our news sources? Today, I have the pleasure of speaking to award-winning journalist Lisa Sorg. Lisa is the North Carolina reporter for Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning national outlet. A journalist for 31 years, Lisa has a keen interest not only in the environment, but also the social justice impacts of pollution and corporate malfeasance. She has won dozens of awards for her news, public service, and investigative reporting. In 2025, Lisa's series Gaslighting won a National Feature Writing Award in the Small Division in the Society for Advancing Business Editing and Writing. The multi-part series chronicled the struggles of people fighting the natural gas buildout in North Carolina. In 2022, Lisa was co-winner of the Thomas L. Stokes Award for Environmental and Energy Reporting, presented by the National Press Foundation. A native of rural Indiana, she lives in Durham, North Carolina. Lisa, it is such a treat to be able to sit down and talk with you today, as opposed to our normal chats in the Food Lion parking lots. And I really think that before we begin, for the benefit of our listeners, I should talk about how I met you.
Yes.
Which, when I met you, you were a very well-known journalist and editor at that time. I think of the ND magazine, which all Durham residents and Triangle residents will know immediately. But I felt the need to bake and decorate you cookies in the shape of pathogens, STIs, and serve them to you in a Petri dish. And looking back, I think that was seriously maybe the most shameless thing I ever did to make a friend.
I love them. And you know, I only tossed those maybe 2 years ago from my freezer.
Wow. They had a good long run.
They did.
That was probably at least 15 years old.
You gave those to me in 2011. And they lasted in my freezer for, 15 years?
Well, I'm impressed.
Not quite, but
I'm impressed that you gave them space for that long.
Yeah.
So you're one of those people in my life that I know very fortunately as a friend and as a neighbor. And then I start to look at your bio and the work that you've done, and I'm like, holy smokes. So I am really excited today to be able to talk about your professional work and accomplishments. And I had noted that we're going to jump around here today a little bit, and I'm sure it's not what a professional journalist would do.
You'd be surprised.
Okay. But I wanted to bring to the top some really notable accomplishments that you've had in the last little bit. So one is hot off the press. Could you tell us about what that is?
Yes. So just last week, they announced, they meaning the Society for the Advancement of Business and Society for the Advancement of Business Writing and Editing, something like that. It's a business journalism society, and I won a national award for my series called Gaslighting, which was going into underserved communities and reporting on their fights against the fossil fuel industry.
In North Carolina?
In North Carolina, and it won in the small division for feature writing. And it was a great honor, but it was also a reflection of how to, as we were going to discuss today, how to win trust.
Yes. Congratulations.
Thank you.
In 2022, you also won the National Press Foundation's Thomas L. Stokes Award for Best Energy and Environment Writing for a two-part piece called Clear and Present Danger. And it's fantastic. Can you tell us what that's about?
Yes, I can. So can I tell you a little bit about how it came to be?
I'd love it.
So this was during the pandemic. It was in 2021, I believe, or 20, yes. And I was bored, as we all were, trapped inside our houses. So I thought to myself, you know, I'm going to take a drive and, this is serious, look, try to find some hazardous waste sites.
That's what it does.
Because I am the life of the party. So I had a list, and I started with Alamance County because it's first in the alphabet. Makes sense. So I found this one place called Apollo Chemical, and it wasn't all that exciting. And I'm driving back to Durham through the center of Burlington on Church Street, which is also US 70.
Yeah.
And I saw something in my periphery, and it's this amazing sarcophagus of a building or buildings. And I thought it was an old mill initially.
Sure, yeah.
And I thought, that is beautiful in all of its decay. And I'm really into decay. I like decay. So I drove over there and parked, and I just couldn't believe it. It was went on forever, and there were broken windows, but there were these beautiful geometry, and I was like, whoa. And then I go to this, it's Hilton Avenue, and I'm looking at all these houses, and they're clearly low-income houses, renters, definitely low-income, marginalized community, and their backyards are 50 feet from this place.
Fear.
And I'm thinking, that's bad. Yeah. Whatever this is, it's not good to have houses that close. So I went home, looked it up. It is the former Tar Heel Army missile plant.
No. In Burlington, North Carolina?
In Burlington, North Carolina. And it is highly polluted. It has polluted below the ground. It has polluted above the ground. And the people in this neighborhood had no idea, except, well, there was one guy who knew, and he'd lived there for a while. But these were folks who were all black and brown. Some of them did not speak English as a first language or were not really even conversational in it. And some people thought it was a hospital at one time. The public health department is right down the block.
I know exactly where this is. And the residents had never been informed of any possible risk to their health by anyone.
No, and nothing had, there had been no remediation for 30 years. It had just sat there. And it's the federal government is responsible for all the pollution that's below the ground. And believe me, there's a lot. And there's a plume of contamination that has seeped through the groundwater into a creek that runs through the middle of the neighborhood, which people wade in. I mean, there's graffiti in the like aqueduct. And even though these folks are on public water, there's still concerns about vapor intrusion and all these things. Anyway, this is underneath the houses. And the good news is, believe it or not, that because of my stories and, you know, asking the federal government, what are you doing? They have begun to clean it up.
Wonderful. How many years elapsed between the?
2.5.
2.5 years. That's an amazing impact in 2.5 years.
And I did small follow-ups here and there because they found that there was, in addition to the solvents that are beneath the ground, there are perfluorinated compounds, which are very toxic. And if you read the history of this plant, oh my gosh, they were pouring radium down the drain into the sewers in the 50s and 60s.
I remember this article, I think I remember this correctly, a man was talking about his backyard being boggy or something. Like, and I'm thinking about children that might have been exposed to a huge part of their life. I mean, if it's been there for that long, these are adults.
Yes. Well, and also these, you know, you go down the block and you can see tricycles in the yard, you know, toys, and the stormwater runoff, you know, when it rains, of course, it floods somewhat. And so all that, whatever is on that, in that plant or on the surface, is flowing into their yards. And there was also some illegal demolition going on by the person who owns the property now. And when he was doing this illegal demolition, rats were being flushed out. And this one woman told me in Spanish that, you know, there were rats that her dogs were killing and that were running to the yard. And she has children.
Oh, my gosh. I read this article absolutely, my mouth like hanging open. And this will not feel like a compliment to you, but to me, it's high praise. It's very Erin Brockovich-y for those of you who like that sort of thing, because it was, I think it was investigative journalism, in my opinion, in its highest purpose, in that someone referred to it in the article as environmental justice. And I don't know if that was your intent, but I do find that that's a common thread. You write, the environmental cost of this inaction have been borne by predominantly Black, Latinx, and Indigenous neighborhoods. The plant abuts 6 duplexes and 2 single-family homes. Another half dozen duplexes face the facility. At least 6 more households lie within the contamination path. Just to give people the full context of really what you saw when you got there. And both in this project and the one that you did in the gaslighting, you're going into communities. You're a petite white woman.
Yes.
And you're going into communities that have been historically oppressed environmentally in many situations. How do you build trust as a journalist within those marginalized communities as you do this work, as you really try to capture their experience as stranger, right?
Yeah. Well, there are 2 ways to go about it. The easy way is if you know, when you start doing this long enough, people hear about you, and sometimes you can have a community liaison. Someone who is already connected, maybe it's someone in the church, in the neighborhood or something, and you can then just make a connection with that one single person, and then they open the door for you. That's the way that is amazing and probably the path of least resistance. In this case, for Clear and Present Danger, that there was no such person. And so there are 2 things that work in my favor. One, I am small.
Very.
And I think that puts people at ease. I'm non-threatening. And not just physically, but, you know, I have a big smile and I am genuine. But also I am humble. I approach them from a position of humility. And also I try to flip the script on myself and say, what if somebody came up to me? Because there's a power differential, and just as there is in medicine.
And in trust in general, I would argue.
Yes.
There's always a more vulnerable half.
Yes, because I have the information.
Yes.
A lot of information. Now, I want information from them, but I'm holding a lot of cards, and they don't know what they look like.
And you get control of how to disseminate that information.
Right. So one thing that I have done is, once I feel like I'm connecting with someone, first of all, there's no high pressure tactics. I tell them exactly why I'm there, what I'm doing, what's at stake. I basically pitch the story in a way to them. And I tell them why their insight is important if they choose to share it. And then I almost give them a crash course in journalism. This is how I will go about this. This is how I will fact check this. This is how you will not be surprised by anything that's in this story that, you know, involves you. We'll go over everything. And I not only go over their quotes, but the contextual information in which their quotes appear, the graphs before and after. I mean, I go the extra mile.
Yes, you do.
And that puts people at ease. Sometimes people still don't want to talk. And then you just say, well, thank you.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you don't take it personally. I mean, some people don't.
Yeah.
I think the one of the issues that I in this Burlington neighborhood is that I used to be pretty fluent in Spanish. I lived in Texas for 5.5 years, mm-hmm. and I went to school there to learn Spanish. And this kind of goes to the trust issue, because Spanish is obviously widely spoken in San Antonio, and I wanted to be able to show respect by interviewing people in their native language.
Excellent.
Now, it has fallen off, but Duolingo is helping, although it's really a little elementary for me, but I'm getting there. But long way of saying, I wanted to speak to the people as best I could in Spanish, even if it was broken, even though they might secretly be laughing at me, that's fine. I just wanted them to know I was trying to reach them where they are. And,
yeah,
you know, that's another way of gaining trust is, you know, if somebody did that to me, I think, well, they're trying.
Same in healthcare. Exactly. Exactly. It's such a respectful gesture, and it shows off the bat an attempt to see someone, don't you think?
I do. And that's the other thing, is that it's important to see the person in all their complexity. These are not cutout characters. There are times when I interview people and I don't like them very much. It doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, I mean, they're still entitled to clean water and clean air and a safe place to live. It does not matter what, you know, I think of them. I mean, if they, I guess, murdered somebody, I would obviously have a strong opinion about that. But the point being, I'm not there to judge them. I am there to listen to what their valid concerns are.
Yes. And to report that in a way, I guess, that's as true as you can make it to their experience.
Yes, absolutely.
So I've read your work for, well, almost 2 decades now. I mean, decade and a half. When did I make you the SDI? And I was thinking of words that I would use to describe your work, and they just have this thick, immovable through line to me of integrity, really deep compassion. When you think about your work as a journalist, do you feel a responsibility to promote justice? Do you approach your work through that lens?
I definitely, yes. I got into this business, in the news business, environmental journalism, but even before that in other beats, because I don't want to be a cop. I don't want to be a lawyer. Don't have the patience for that. But I want to help people. And I thought about going into medicine when I was young, because I want really to make this world a better place. And, you know, I don't consider myself at all an advocacy journalist. I consider myself on the side of truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so many times marginalized communities they're not validated. You know, mm-hmm. scientists may say, well, that's just your experience. It doesn't meet the threshold of, you know, reproducible results or whatever.
Rigor.
Yes. And okay, I get that. I get that as the scientific method, but that's not to discount their feelings. You know, maybe they are having digestive problems and they attribute it to their water. Well, maybe it's not their water, but it could be something else.
Right. There's something there.
There's something happening.
Sure.
And when I see corporations come in, for example, and say, there's nothing wrong with you, it's all in your head, or our studies show there's nothing wrong, that, you know, they have an agenda.
Oh, sure.
You know, they're telling them that for a reason. They're not telling them that to, because they're out of the goodness of their heart.
Right. That dismissal is a way to decrease their culpability, their liability.
Yes.
All of those things. Do you see yourself as casting this sort of bright light of truth upon the people who may not have voices that you feel like you get to be, have the honor really of being a voice for people whose voices may not be heard?
Right. And I think you put that really well. Some people say it's voice to the voiceless. Well, they have voices.
Yeah.
It's just they're screaming into the void.
That's exactly right.
And so the journalist is there to make sure they don't scream into the void. And also because, you know, a lot of these folks are, you know, they have other jobs, they have children, they have complicated lives like all of us. They're not going to know to call Chemours and say, well, the parts per trillion, blah, bitty, blah. You know, they're not going to have time to verse themselves in the nuance of the science or, you know, and also they might be afraid. I mean, journalists are trained to, at least investigative journalists, to confront people as difficult. And I don't like it, really. I mean, people would think, oh, she's always confronting people. She must like it. I don't like it. But I will do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you've done that in the past, has there ever been pushback on your report?
Oh, my God. Oh, Jill. From the state of North Carolina.
Can you say more about that?
Yes, I'm happy to. So I did 31 stories about the state of North Carolina's Office of Recovery and Resiliency and how they failed the people of Eastern North Carolina, hurricane survivors. People died before they got back home. They were not building their homes quickly. People were living in motels for 4 years without kitchens. And one woman I remember, she was giving herself dialysis in her motel room that did not have a kitchenette. So
Oh my gosh. Clearly,
they need, you know, if you're on dialysis, you should have a certain diet. I mean, this is...
It's life-saving treatment that's supposed to be done in a well-controlled clinical environment.
So how I met those people, well, speaking of going in and cold calling, so first of all, the people with the dialysis and her husband, they were lovely, and they sent me a letter. They had seen, I had done one story, and they sent me a letter in the mail, and I opened it, and they had sent it to the Attorney General's office. I mean, every state senator. And I called them and said, I got your letter. Can I come visit you? And they said, yes, you're the only one who responded. Sometimes, I'm telling you, Jill, half this job is showing up. I got a tip with all the names and addresses of the people who were out of a home, which I wasn't supposed to have, but thank you, tipster. And I started driving around North Carolina and just going up to people's houses. And that's kind of scary these days. I went to one guy's house who had, like, no trespassing. Trespassers will be shot. You know, survivors will be shot again. And I'm thinking, I did not want to go up to this guy. And in his house, he was living in a motel, but he was there actually, like, feeding his dog or something. Yeah. And he was in his driveway, and I just kind of walk up, and I said, sir, you know, I was making myself even smaller. Like, I'm 5'3", I was trying to shrink to, like, 4'10". And I told him why I was there, that I'd heard that he was out of his house. And he says, come on in.
Really?
He spent an hour and a half with me, told me everything, took me inside this scary, you know, flood-damaged house. I'm like, this is the part of the movie where I die. My mother is, like, saying the rosary right now. But he was lovely.
Isn't that amazing? I do think... I've found that in healthcare too, that it's about preparing the space.
Mm-hmm.
And if you prepare the space, people are often anxious to tell their stories.
Yes.
And I have always found the honor of being told these stories as a stranger to these people knocked me out every single day.
Yes, they're trusting you. I mean, that's a huge exchange of trust. And to answer your question, though, after these first stories came out, the head of the Office of Recovery and Resiliency went after me, went to my boss. The governor's office said it was a hit job. I mean, I took immense amount of abuse from those people. But I had the receipts, and I thought, you are not going to cow me. And it took 31 stories over 2.5 years, several legislative oversight committee hearings, and the head finally left.
Is that so? I know having these interactions with the public and getting to talk to your sources is deeply rewarding, but there must be something intensely satisfying as an investigative journalist about feeling that there was this downstream effect from it that is ultimately going to benefit the people that you form these relationships with.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's why you do it. I mean, and not every, most stories actually don't turn out that way. But when they do, it's incredibly rewarding. And, you know, one thing I want to say about the hurricane folks, the survivors, is, you know, in the height of that reporting, I was getting calls at all hours, you know, like 10 o'clock at night, people crying. I had to take a couple weeks off at the end of, I think it was 23. I don't want to say I was having secondhand trauma. That sounds way too dramatic, but I was being affected mentally by their stories.
Moral injury, I'm sure, resulting from that, because you're so proximal to the grief, to the loss, to the anger, to the resiliency that I think that you see. I don't know, and I would be curious, can you be a really good investigative journalist without getting attached?
You have to care. You have to have skin in the game, and that doesn't mean you ignore the facts or that you skew your story to favor one side or the other, but your duty is to the truth, and that's what I'm attached to. I'm attached to the truth and whoever else is attached to the truth.
Right.
And I think the thing that is the hardest is that I still have to have a little bit of distance. You know, I still have ethical rules.
Yep.
For example, there was one individual who has a lot of, he's sight impaired and he has other challenges. And I can't help them. You know, I can't give them money or help them in any, except for in a most de minimis way.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, after the series concluded and I knew that I would no longer be speaking with him as a source, you know, I gave him some furniture that I had. That was not a big lift for me, but
I've done the same thing with patients, because at some point I felt, and obviously you feel, a responsibility to something even larger than your job, which is the human condition.
Yes. And I'm always clear with those folks, you know, I'm giving you this as a person. You owe me nothing in return.
Yes. Yes. Because they've already given you something.
Yeah.
I mean, it is reciprocal in the sense that they've shown up with their full humanity, and then your roles switch around a little bit, and then you get to show up with your full humanity.
Absolutely.
To them. So now you are the North Carolina reporter for Inside Climate News, a fancy Pulitzer Prize winning nonprofit newsroom. So congratulations.
Thank you.
I would say not long ago, an outlet with that kind of pedigree would have inferred inherent trust in the content. And I think for many, it still does. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also no denying that there's been a real assault on reporting in general. What is credible? What is fake news? And sometimes I struggle myself with trust in the media because I do feel like even the most credible news outlets have a need to bring in readers, right? Mm-hmm. And so there seems to be this very fine balance that credible reporters have to walk between doing their reporting and also doing it in a way that keeps the newsroom afloat. So I'm curious about how this is showing up in your work.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I've not encountered this so much here, but I know that some of my colleagues who are on the national desk do, but the fact that the word climate is in our name can be a turnoff for some people.
I can see that now. Yes.
And so, you know, fortunately, I haven't had to confront that quite as much. But I think the thing that's the hardest is that, you know, we're very science-based, mm-hmm. I mean, just like medicine, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, science evolves. We used to think that, you know, our bile were what was causing, you know, our problems.
Our ether.
Yeah, people were having trepanation and drilling holes in their head. We come a long way.
Yes.
But we go with the best that we know at the time.
Yeah.
And when people doubt the science or twist the science, or when there's disinformation, I mean, it is a battle. And there's been so much disinformation in Western North Carolina, for example, about recovery and rescues. And, you know, I remember talking to one person who, you know, was making very incredible allegations. And when I asked for proof, vanish, you know. So even if you have science on your side, there's some people you'll never convince.
Yeah. So this distrust in science that I'm showing up in your work, do you feel as your role as a journalist, you need to actively debunk these falsehoods that you're hearing? Or do you feel like your role is more just to concentrate solely on just reporting the facts? How do you find that balance?
I think we do both.
Okay.
So if someone says something without evidence, then we say so, maybe in a more articulate way, but we make it clear that someone has made this statement. Let's just say measles vaccines cause autism.
Okay, sure.
They don't.
Don't take that out of context.
But you would say that, you know, and I've seen other media do this, you know. But so you counter that. Not all. Just because someone says it doesn't make it true. And you don't want to perpetuate the falsehood, but by just letting it lie there.
Yes.
You challenge it, you counter it, and that's our responsibility. And I'll give you an example. This is when I was an editor at The Indian, and I had an intern who was quoting someone who said that homosexuality was a choice, or, you know, was basically not giving validation to the fact that it's inborn.
Yes.
And I said to the intern, I said, well, you can quote that person saying that, but you need to push back on that. You have to challenge that statement with the current science.
Right.
And they said, well, really? Yeah. Yeah, you do. Because somebody's just going to read that and say, oh, well, they said it. Must be true.
Well, because they trust your outlet.
Yes.
Right? I mean, that is the responsibility, I think. I want to talk a little bit more about the trust in media is, you know, if you don't actively debunk things that you know to be false, then in some ways you inadvertently are not perpetuated.
That's absolutely true. And if you don't know something, it's okay to say so.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
And that's true in medicine. If they say, we don't know what caused your rash, I'd rather hear that than, well, it might be eczema. Could be melanoma. You know, I mean, you know, you just want to know what they know and what they don't know.
Exactly. And I think that there's always going to be an opportunity, especially in media, to find something that will support your bias of whatever.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
And I imagine that is a really, really tricky part of investigative journalism or journalism in general, which is what you've done, which is had a sustained, deliberate career with a very solid line path that allows people to see your name and have trust in that work, right? Like your reputation that you've built lends its own credibility. People feel like they can trust you. Do you feel like that?
I'd say generally, yes. I mean, there are the, you know, the naysayers out there, but I would say I work very hard to maintain that integrity because at the end of the day, if you don't have integrity as a journalist, if you are someone who gets a reputation for burning sources, for not quoting people accurately, for not acting in good faith, well, then you might as well go work at Cookout because you're not gonna last.
Right, or just post random stuff to Instagram.
Right.
Yeah, that's your other option. So, you know, I'm writing a dissertation right now, and it takes me so long to write anything. The idea of having a job where my job was to write on demand is so terrifying to me. It makes me a little apoplectic to think about. Obviously, journalism has changed a lot in probably the last, certainly in your career, but I think just in the last few years in terms of the urgency of the content and just how fast it's coming out and where you can get it. And I think, how has that affected really the quality of the journalism we're seeing? And how does that affect our ability to trust what we're reading? I mean, there has to be some trade-off, I imagine, with efficiency and productivity versus quality.
Very much so. So stenography is really easy to do. But, for example, that Burlington story, Clear and Present Danger, that took 5 months. Now, I did other stories, but not a ton. So I think there's a balance. Sometimes, you know, if there's a hurricane or something, you've got to try to pull the trigger quickly and do something meaningful, you know, that not every, and especially if you're not the paper of record or the immediate outlet of record, you've got to find another aspect maybe of the story rather than just if it bleeds, it leads. You want to, you know, do something different. If they zig, you want to zag. But I think practicing slow news, there's nothing wrong with that because people only have so many hours in the day, too, readers. Not just us as journalists, but how much do you want to read in a day? I mean,
I think it's an affliction. I was reading a thing about Oliver Berkman last night, who I love, and he was talking about news does not equal your life, and that an over preoccupation with news can actually diminish our quality of life because then it actually ends up kind of separating us as humans.
Yes. So you... My goal when I write a story is I want somebody to feel like they invested the time to read it and they got a return on that investment.
Yes. My husband, who you know, has won the New Yorker caption contest twice.
I bow at him.
I know. He's amazing. He's a very creative man. A reader, he is not. And so we get the New Yorker at great expense. It sits around at our house and does nothing because now I'm a grad student and I can't read it. And I said to him one day, Pete, why don't you read The New Yorker? And he said, the articles are so long.
Wow.
And I love the articles. And so I think that you can't deny that reading an article in The New Yorker is a very different experience than reading a news article.
Absolutely. Well, when I also subscribe to The New Yorker, which is how when I see his name winning again...
Peter,
I put myself in a certain mindset. Like, I am now going to read The New Yorker, which means for the next 45 minutes, I am going into the submarine of The New Yorker. And then in 45 minutes, I will exit the submarine of The New Yorker. And I just surrender myself to it. And
me too. It's a meditative state.
It is. It is.
Absolutely. But I think what allows that to happen is sort of the slow unraveling, the cadence of the reporting, which draws you in, which builds that kind of trust, which shows the due diligence and the really thoughtful way in which that is done. It's almost the difference between, you know, fast food and the slow food movement.
Yes.
And it's almost also, for me, this attention to the craft, to the art that you see. And when a journalist has displayed that, as a reader, the credibility in that journalist and their work, even if I don't always agree with everything I'm reading, because I don't always agree with everything I'm reading, I still have a deep respect for the process in which it was crafted.
And they do such incredibly deep reporting. And here's an example of how a journalist can win trust of their audience through just small details. So in Gaslighting, it's a five-part series, and one of the part two was about these beekeepers, lovely beekeepers in between Davidson and Forsyth County.
Is that right?
Yeah. Near Midway, I guess. And I remember they invited me. How did I get to know them? I had a liaison. And it took a while to get a hold of them, but they invited me into their home and they showed me their bees. And I went there several times and just hung out and played music and fed the bees. It was so awesome.
So cool.
But at one point they said they brought biscuits from Bojangles. And I went inside and we all had biscuits and honey from the bees on it. And so they knew they were on the record then, but I was able to describe this, like, them passing the biscuits, they're, you know, putting the dollop of the honey on. There was something about being present in that moment, recording the conversation and then putting that in print, that the reader is going to say, she was there. I trust her. She was there. She's watching the plates. being passed.
She was there and she was immersed. She was experiencing it in the same way that everyone else was experiencing it. Yeah. That comes through so much in your journalism. And I think it came through so much in the Clear and Present Danger piece.
Yeah.
As well, even your comments about the architecture of the buildings. And there are pictures in that article. I didn't really need them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was just so, so nice. And I'm going to put it on the website, a link to it, because it's very good. So now you're an adjunct professor at Wake Forest University, which is my alma mater. And I'm envious of those students. I know you've had some great experiences.
I have. I love it there.
And what, and you're not teaching this semester, but what are you going to be teaching next?
I'm teaching environmental journalism again next semester. I'm very excited. So I've taught three semesters. First one was intro. That was my baptism by fire. I think that was them testing me to see if I could
hang.
It was interesting. I liked teaching intro, though. And then I taught a deep dive that was about food insecurity. And then I taught environmental journalism. And so I'm doing that again next semester. And the students are wonderful. And
aren't
I love
they?
Them.
Yes. Since I can't be in that class, but I do get this time with you, one of the questions I would also have for you if I were taking that class is, if you could go into a little bit more detail, kind of like, what advice do you give these very young, very green, budding journalists who are also very passionate, very smart, very committed about how to set the bedrock of their career with integrity, with establishing that trust? Because I imagine it's easier to do it at this point than to try to find your way back to it at some point.
Right. So there are several concepts that I introduce them to. One is verify everything. You know, I had one student who had heard, this was in an intro class, had heard that there were, you know, sex traffickers on campus. I was like, oh, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
And I said, well, how do you know this? Did you get a police report or, you know? Well, I saw it on Fizz, which is the campus, like, gossip app. And I said, that is not a source.
It's like Wikipedia isn't a source.
Yeah. It's,
yeah.
You know, that's like when I was a kid and my mom would get, you know, a phone call from Susie down the block saying, you know, did you hear what I heard?
Exactly.
It's like just gave a telephone.
It's gossip.
And yes. It's nothing there. It was not true.
Right. But inflammatory, right? I mean, it's juicy.
It is, but it was totally false. And I'm like, that's not a story unless you can prove it. So when, in environmental journalism, you know, I think one of the things that has done a disservice to incoming students is this. There's so much influencer PR kind of quote unquote, I won't call it journalism, but storytelling out there that they don't understand the difference between public relations and journalism. And I have to immediately, especially in intro, not so much in environment, but to some extent, like they want to make people happy with their stories. I'm like, that's not your job. In fact, if you're going to do investigative journalism, someone's going to be really unhappy. So I have to tell them to be skeptical, but not dismissive. You know, there's a lot of nuance that I think I have to get across to them, which when you're 19 is hard. You know, you don't always see the nuance in the world. I mean, I didn't.
No, because I think that just in any career, the more life works you, the more critically and thoughtfully you show up.
Yeah.
And some people, that's not true. Some people never learn.
Unfortunately.
But I think for a lot of people, the evolution of their career, you can see these points, these inflection points where you think, oh, that actually changed me in this way.
Yes.
And I think that hopefully with journalism, we can keep that ability to have trust in our journalist by incorporating some of those practices that you said from the very beginning. Because I think it sounds silly to say to somebody, like, verify your sources, but we see so much that's not verified, right? We hear public figures talk all the time about things that are not verified. And so it kind of sets up this tension, right, between what people are saying in power versus what investigators have investigated.
Yeah.
And I imagine that that's frustrating for you.
Yes.
To hear.
Well, often, you know, what when they turn in a draft of their story, and most of my comments, at least at the beginning of the semester, are, how do you know this? How do you know this?
Yeah.
How do you know this? So that's always something I put at the head of the class. And I think I try to impress upon them the enormous responsibility that they're undertaking. I want them to feel the gravity of it.
Do you think they do?
They do. At the same time, I think I have a reputation as a pretty, I don't know, enjoyable professor. I don't.
Sure you do.
I don't teach like other people do. It's not a super formal. I mean, we sit in a class and all that, but we rap and we, you know.
Not an academic.
I'm not an academic.
Yeah.
I remember when they were thinking of hiring me, and one of the professors asked me what my theory, my pedagogical theories were, and I'm like, people can learn?
Wait.
Well, and I think the one thing that I did say is that when I was in college, I was lost. I had a very undistinguished, well, I started out on the dean's list. I ended up on probation.
Wow.
And I said, I always want to be there for the students who are lost. They deserve just as much, if not more, attention than the ones who are on the fast track. They've got an internship. You know, they have friends, their parents' friends work at the Post or whatever. They're going to be fine.
I think you can't overstate the impact of really, again, seeing your students like you do your sources, right?
And yeah.
Full spectrum of what they're bringing. And in this case, a lot of overachieving children who suddenly feel less competent than maybe they had in their life.
Right, because everyone's overachieving at Wake Forest. And I didn't really think of that when, because I never envisioned I'd ever teach on the, I don't have a master's, which is why I'm an adjunct. And I'm happy to be plankton in the university world.
Yep.
But, you know, as a state school, it's different. You know,
yes.
you've been in whatever, you know, you could have been anywhere in your class ranking. Mm-hmm. But I also tell them that whatever happens in their university experience, you know, most of the time will not define them for the rest of their lives.
So before we close, I'm going to tell you one of the many, many things I love about you.
Sweet.
And that's true, though. And that is that you recently went to the Dukes of Hazzard Museum. I love the Dukes of Hazzard growing up. And I didn't even know that this existed.
Have you been?
No, because I didn't know until you went that it existed.
I do gotta go.
I imagine that I would come back a changed person.
It'll blow your mind.
Yeah, and it's close, right?
It's in Potosin County.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
on Helena Road.
Okay.
It's on the Google Maps.
Yeah.
If you Google it, it'll show up on the map.
The Dukes of Hazzard Museum.
Yeah.
It's a treasure, apparently, in North Carolina.
People from all over the world go to this place. When I opened the guest book, it was like, Chile. Poland. I'm like, really? And I mean, it wasn't fake, you know? It was truly, that's where.
Yeah.
And the guy who runs it builds exhibits at the Museum of Life and Science.
No. So they're really well done.
Oh, it's amazing.
Okay. Well, if you want a redo, I'll take you back. But when I saw that you'd been to the Dukes of Hazzard Museum, I thought, yeah, this is why I love Lisa. And I'll tell you what. Because it's hard to bear the weight of the world all the time. Now, I think for me, at least, and many of the people that I love more than ever, and I imagine that for journalists, it's especially hard because you're a frontline worker, you're like healthcare, you're up against the human experience in a way that those of us just consuming the news are not up against it. And you just remind me through your sense of humor and your love of living things, the environment, your cats, your love, your passion for walking long distances. You walked this interview about this critical need of levity in our lives.
Yes.
And you are an inspiration to me.
Thank you so much. That means a lot to me. Well, levity is really important because it's laugh or cry. And, you know, there are days when I get pretty down, but then, you know, you go out and you see that the birds have built a nest
somewhere really cool, and, you know, your spinach is coming up, and you're walking down the street, and you find something cool. I found a beautiful nest that some bird had made with twigs and lint.
Ah.
And it was like this wild representation of the human intervention of the natural world. And I have a house full of nests.
I love that.
If you came into my house, it's like the cabinet of curiosities.
Love that.
And
minus my STD cookies.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, you know, I was getting a new freezer and I felt like, you know, I had to.
But surrounding yourself with the affirming part, do you feel like it kind of counterbalances what you see in terms of the destructive decay?
Yes, because, you know, I was driving to Chapel Hill or Carrboro yesterday to see an old friend I hadn't seen in 30 years. And I saw this swath along 15 and 501 that's been completely, all the trees have been cut down, you know, for development or whatever. I'm sure it was for development. And I think about the habitat loss, and I think about the carbon dioxide going into the air. And, you know, then I think about the housing needs. And, you know, I think the other thing I tell my students, and that I remind myself every day about nuance, you cannot live a 100% pure life. You do the best you can every day and try to put something good in the world every day, regardless of whether you ever get that reward back. It's just your job as a human who happens to be alive at this moment to put goodness in the world every day.
Hey, before you go, here's a shameless plea. If you like this episode, hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to your podcast. That way you'll never miss a new episode. You can also find more about us at trustfundpodcast.com and follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn. If you loved what you heard, I trust you to leave a 5-star rating. It really helps others find the show. Trust Fund is a production of Jill Surgeson and the Duke University School of Nursing.